It's hardcore history. Addendum.
So I am a Dan Jones fan, and many of you are too, no doubt. He's one of our finest writers of history for the period in the Middle Ages, you know, the fall of Rome to the Renaissance. A lot of stuff that made up what a lot of us grew up with loving. I mean, knights in shining armor, crusades, Normans, Saxons. I mean, this is pretty par for the course for a lot of history fans. And if that's your jam, then you need to pick up Dan Jones's new book, Powers and Thrones. He's with us today to talk about it. But you've probably already read his stuff. The Plantagenets was great. The Wars of the Roses, Crusaders, the Templars, Magna Carta. The book covers the entire period from the fall of Rome to the Renaissance in the European, Middle Eastern, North African sort of zone. 656 pages. I looked it up, covering 1,000 years. That's audacious, isn't it? But just like there's a lot of interesting stuff you can glean from a very narrowly focused, you know, targeted work on a small chunk of history so you can really delve into it, turn over every stone, examine it to the nth degree, there are advantages to doing the opposite. You get a much larger sense of how cultures are working together and pinging off each other, larger sense of trends impacting over time, right? They all have their place. And Jones's book is one of those that if you actually retained what's in it, it would fill in your foundational knowledge base for a huge chunk of time and a large, important region, geographically speaking. It's a page-turner. There's a lot of historical figures that we've all fallen in love with that fall into a book like this. What I love about it, though, is at the same time that it's comforting, if you've always been interested in this stuff to read this book, it's comforting for me anyway, he's got all the new stuff, right? All the new discoveries, all the clarifications, all the overturned myths. We've talked before about how interesting it is now that the area of historical knowledge is aided not just by historians and archaeologists, the people that have always sort of had that as their purview, but tons of other scientific disciplines that working with these people are making the kinds of discoveries and datings possible that we never could have imagined. I mean, just the other day there was a story, and you may have seen it, confirming certainly what many of us had already known, that the Vikings had arrived in the Americas, but coming up with a pretty solid date for it. And they said 1021, you know, 1021 AD CE. And when you read the story of how they came up with the date, the radiologists that are involved, the climatologists that are involved, I mean, it is so many experts from so many varied fields working together to get us this information. Anyway, it's fascinating. It's a part of what makes the modern historical study so interesting to people, you know, who've been reading the books forever, but all of a sudden you have new stuff on old stories, right? Who doesn't love that? And Powers and Thrones has a bunch of those where you're going, oh, really? So this major invasion happened because of a climate change that they can now prove was going on. I mean, it's that kind of thing. So I loved it. I think you'll enjoy it too. And if you're a Dan Jones fan, I don't have to tell you what he writes are sort of page turners in terms of being able to pick out really interesting things. It's fabulous, and so is he, and he's on the show today. And so without further ado, and I hope you like this, but I'm just sort of fanboying out. It's more for me than for you. But, you know, you guys pay the bills around here, so I'll let you listen in. Dan Jones, ladies and gentlemen. The first thing I want to say is that this book, you know, I think I tried to describe it once as comfort food for a history fan like yours truly, because I grew up reading stuff like this. But what I love about your book is it incorporates all these favorite topics of mine with all the latest stuff, right? The latest evidence and theories. And I mean, I remember, for example, when you got to the part about the famous arrival of the Huns into the Roman world, and you threw the climate element in there and talked about, is it called a Kilian juniper plant or whatever that they used for climate dating? I was absolutely enthralled. So start off, I mean, there's a lot of people that think that history is sort of a set thing, and because once you know what happens, nothing changes. But talk to me about, you know, like I said, a guy, yours truly, I was reading this stuff at 14 years old, 13, 12, and there's so much new stuff in a story that I thought I knew. That's pretty normal, though, isn't it? I mean, we're always updating stuff, aren't we?
Well, firstly, I mean, thank you for those kind comments, and I'm glad it like the book reminded you of those classic histories that you like to read, because I like to read those histories too. And I wanted to create a book that had that feel, like you want to turn the pages, like I could give this to an intelligent 13-year-old and get them like buzzed on medieval history. But if we're talking about, I suppose we're going pretty deep here early on, like what is history? And history is a dialogue, I think, between the past and present. Although in a book like I've just written, it's narrative, it's chronological, it starts at the beginning of the Middle Ages and follows the story through to the end. There's always new research going on in lots of different areas. There's always, and even more than that, every generation has its own preoccupations, which it seeks to somehow see reflected or see the foundations of them in the past. So that's why we can write new histories of, be it the Tudor dynasty, the Plantagenet dynasty, the Second World War, the Mongol conquest or whatever, each generation, because there's always new research to draw on. But even more than that, there's new societal preoccupations to reflect. You know what? So one of those classic books that you've referenced, I don't know, I mean, tell me if you enjoyed this book as well when you were growing up, was Barbara Tuchman's A Distant Mirror.
Oh,
right?
Sure. Have it up in the bookshelf. Yeah, I can see it from here.
I mean, that's a great book. That's a book that takes the calamitous 14th century, and it's written in, I think, 1974, and uses the 14th century as the title suggests, a distant mirror on the 20th, another time of war and instability in Europe and plague and social turmoil. And when I started writing Powers and Thrones, I set out to write this history of the Middle Ages. I thought, how do we do that for the 21st century? How do we look at the Middle Ages with a sense of what matters to us today and thereby create a form of empathy in the mind of the reader? And so when I tackled the Middle Ages, I was looking for things that I actually had a list of things I thought were going to be important, were already important, were going to become more important as the first half of the 21st century went on. And that list was climate change, mass migration, pandemic disease, technological change, and global networks. So as I was putting together this new history of the Middle Ages, I didn't seek to just only look at those things, but I thought if we can lift those out of the research, lift those out of the storytelling, then this will make the Middle Ages somehow seem approachable to this, you know, be it an intelligent 13-year-old reading history for the first time, or, you know, someone of our kind of generation reading history for the 15th time. That's the big philosophy of what I've been doing anyway.
There's a line I like from an Ohio State University historian named Robert C. Davis, who says, history is, often as not, our present politics projected onto the past. And that makes it sound artificial, but the way I look at it is like when I'm reading your book and you're referencing climate change, tipping off certain major historical events, I recall that when I was younger, they still talked about climate change doing this, but because we understand and are living through more climate change than we were when I was younger, I think we get it better, if that makes sense. Look, you had talked about like globalized networks. Well, you know, you understood that in 1982 also, but boy, you understand it so much better now when we live in it and it's so in your face. So I think that's just reflective of a better understanding that we have of how those things go now in our world, and then it's easier to imagine how they might have impacted an earlier world.
Yeah, and I think that history, as you know well, goes through like trends.
Yes.
In terms of its kind of scholarly concern.
Fashion, yes.
And some fashions, right? And sometimes that every so often someone will come along and say, you know what, history should be objective. It should be about truth seeking and truth alone and the facts. Let's stick to the facts. And that will be fashionable for a little while. And then some bright spark will go, you know what, you don't have to be a kind of French relativist philosopher to realize there is no objective truth. There's perspectives, you know, the relativity defines how we think about the world. And so as a historian, as I've gotten older and a bit more confident, I suppose, I've stopped trying to shy away from this feeling that I've tried to avoid this feeling that we shouldn't project our own concerns into the our study of the past, because otherwise, what's history for? History's like about creating a context for the now, and so it's not just inevitable; it's natural, and it's probably advisable that we take with us, or as long as we acknowledge them, we take with us our preconceptions, our prejudices, our concerns, our angst, our worries, when we go looking at the past, man. Otherwise, why are we bothering? What are we going to learn from it? If it's not there to give us context on the now.
Well, and I think sometimes if you're not looking for something, you don't find it. And sometimes you don't know you should mm-hmm. be looking for it. And I think certain things, like, I'll just reference the climate again, because to me that was such an obvious. I mean, I remember as a kid hearing about the collapse of the Bronze Age, and climate was one of the things that they threw out there. Drought, starvation, all those things. But I think when you look at our situation, say, well, what's our situation going to be like climate-wise in 100 years, 200 years? It helps sort of inform the listener to go back and go, well, gee, how bad can it get? And when was it bad? And how did they deal with it? And how does an ancient society deal with some of the problems we're looking at? So, I mean, I find it it's funny. It's not just informative and useful as a comparative tool to me. There's a little bit of something that's comforting. I mean, if you've been through something before, it's a little less scary, even if you've never been through it quite this way. So let me talk, because you have to frame something like this, right? If you're going to start a story in the middle, as you do, right? The Middle Ages start in the middle. You have to have sort of a touchstone, right? And the touchstone is the obvious one. It's Rome, right? So you have a civilization that starts as a city-state around the time, the Persians are invading Greece, right? So the 500s is really, and then it goes through the Republican period, and then it goes through the Imperial period. And by the time the Middle Ages start, you have this ancient, and I mean, I try to think about our modern world now, which hasn't existed. If you say the modern world starts in the Renaissance, we haven't existed now as long as Rome was around as a civilization that could trace its roots back to something real. Explain a little bit on how this on what happens to a world when a touchstone that's that concrete goes away.
So you're completely and utterly and 100% correct. The framing of the Middle Ages has to be Rome. That's how when the Middle Ages first was conceived in the 16th century, it was conceived as, by definition, the bit between the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West and the Reformation, and it's a Protestant idea, but the scales falling away from the eyes of the great enlightened new Christians of the 16th century. And you're also absolutely right to point to this longevity of Rome as compared to the longevity of our quote-unquote modern world, if we go back to the 16th century to date the origins of that. What happens when an empire like that falls to bits? I think is, in one sense, the answer is not very much, because it happens relatively slowly. Now, even though in the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, there are cataclysmic events, the sack of Rome by Alaric and the Goths in 410 AD being the most obvious of them, it's not like the Western Roman Empire just falls to bits in one day. I suppose here's a not very encouraging dystopian read on the 21st century. Okay, if we were to hypothesize, and I personally hope this doesn't come to pass, but if we were to hypothesize that we're seeing the end of the United States as a superpower, right? And we're some future historians writing from the 22nd century, we might look back on, say, 9/11. As a spectacular assault on the heart of America that wrought great chaos and tragic death and was horrifying and shocking around the world. But what we wouldn't say was, and at that moment America ceased to be a superpower, would say that was some crazy, there were crazy repercussions to that one event, but to everybody who lived in the 20 years subsequently, it didn't really look like America collapsed. Okay, let's hope that's a dystopian conjecture on my part, but I think you see what I'm saying. So I think if we project that idea back to the collapse of Rome, there were big moments such as, well, Rome's being sacked by Alaric and the Goths, or I don't know, I'm talking to you from the UK, Britannia being sort of jettisoned, like booted off into space from the Roman Empire. These, in retrospect, look like huge moments. But on the other hand, I think if you were living through it, there'd just have been a time of rising instability in different places and at different times, which over the course of several generations added up to the final collapse of the Western Roman Empire. But, you know, even if we think about the distance in time between 410 AD, sack of Rome, and 476, you know, the last recognized Western Roman Empire, that's 66 years. Like, in terms of human lifespans of any age, that's quite a long time. So it's a, what's the analogy I'm looking for? It's a boiling of the frog, I suppose. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Crazy and abstract?
No, it makes sense. I always describe it as, you know, being cut off from the equivalent of the global information superhighway if you're Britain when Rome says you're on your own and whatnot. But as many historians have pointed out, if you're actually living in Italy at this time period, closer to where the center of Roman activity was, things continued differently. It's the hinterlands that feel it first and most strongly and recover the slowest. So let's talk a little about the recovery, because that's one of those periods that I don't think enough people, yours truly included, know enough about, and that's the Carolingian, the attempts to recreate something of Rome's grandeur from the ashes a couple centuries later. And they're connected to these people that, it's funny because the terminology will kill you when you start using terms like Franks to talk about a tribe that the Romans had dealt with, and you're still using Franks to describe Crusaders in the 1100s. Maybe talk about this, because it's almost like when you talk about the Roman ashes, the entities that begin to arise from the ashes, as you said, that you look at and say, they didn't know then that they're going to play a huge role, but we, looking back on it now, realize these Franks are going to be an important entity. Whatever those Franks are, who are the Franks?
Well, the Franks are originally one of many tribes who move into the territories that were ruled by the Western Roman Empire and ceased to be ruled by the Western Roman Empire as these barbarian tribes move, quote unquote, barbarian tribes move in. But you're absolutely right. I mean, look, if we're placing bets in, let's say, the 6th or even the 7th century AD as to who's going to be around in 1,000 years? Is it the Franks? Is it the Burgundians? Is it the Lombards? Is it the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, the Suevi? You know, there's all of these different tribal groups moving around what had been the Western Roman Empire. And at different times, different of them were ascendant. But by the 8th, 9th century, the Franks, who traced in their own mythology, they said that they'd come a wandering from the Trojan Wars originally, but they'd come a wandering from Eastern Europe, probably, Germany, Central and Eastern Europe, across the Rhine into the broadly speaking, the area that we now call France, and had over several generations coalesced into a kingdom. Let's call it a kingdom. It was ruled by kings. First, the Merovingians, the long-haired kings, you know, in which the king was connoted by his, literally by growing his hair very long, and could be deposed by having his hair cut off. And by, the Merovingian dynasty became less politically influential. The Frankish territories were governed on their behalf by mayors of the palace, by politicians. And then they were done away with by a dynasty who we now call the Carolingians, named after Charles Martel, but most famous for producing Charlemagne, the king of the Franks, who had himself crowned in the year 800 as the first Roman emperor of the reborn Western Roman Empire, which came to be the Holy Roman Empire. So we have a barbarian tribe, which over many generations becomes collectively a kingdom, and then they become, for a time under Charlemagne and his descendants, the preeminent force in Western Europe.
the way they sort of absconded with the Roman reputation, title, and all that reminds me of one of those companies that has a great old lineage. Like in the United States, it might be like AT&T or something. And then AT&T goes out of business, but somebody buys the name. And then they get to be the new AT&T, and they get to inherit all that cachet, even though they had nothing to do with the original entity. For those who don't know, or maybe those in Germany right now, the name for France and Germany is still Frankreich, the Empire of the Franks. Mm-hmm. I also like, and I never made this connection when I was reading the Crusades from the Middle Eastern viewpoint. I forget what the book was called. And they referred to the Crusaders from Europe as the Frange. And I remember thinking, French. It just turns Frank into French right there. And then you begin to see the connections, because Frank doesn't mean anything to most people who speak the English language, but French obviously does. And when you see one word morph into the other, you kind of, the light bulb goes on in your head and you go, oh, okay, I see the connection. So this is interesting, though, also, because we did a show a long time ago on that transition period, you know, from Merovingians to Carolingians. And when you read the accounts of what these Merovingian Franks were like, they sound like Vikings. When you look at pictures, and they're, you know, the contemporary type stuff, but they're sort of idea. I don't know if they're idealized or if we've barbarized the Merovingians in their true kind, but they all look so civilized and so King Arthur like, and they look clean and washed and well dressed, and they look like they look very, very civilized. And then when you read the accounts of people like Charles Martel is a perfect example, but some of the Merovingian kings. What's the one who would have people bend over to bow for him, and then he'd split their skull with a battle axe? I mean, they had all these wonderful. So let me ask you, I guess that's what I'm saying in my typically long-winded question, I am getting to somewhere, is that if looking back on it with your eye, which of those two impressions of the Merovingians, the Franks before Charlemagne, and Pepin, his father, which of those two interpretations seems more like to you? Have we barbarized a bunch of people that were more civilized than we thought, or have the chroniclers made a bunch of Viking types look better than they actually were?
I think it, you know, so much is what you want them to be. And I think particularly in the early Middle Ages, late antiquity, early Middle Ages, the evidence is so scant. You know, I'm a late medievalist by inclination, by training. So when I came to writing this new book, a lot of the early Middle Ages was kind of virgin territory for me. And that was one of the reasons I enjoyed doing it. Of course, as it always, you know, you can be swayed very easily at first by the account that you're reading. Now, of course, if you're reading accounts of Romans watching the barbarians swarm over once solid Roman territories, they are barbarians. They're these sort of hideously uncivilized folk who have no right being where they are. But of course, as time goes by and those hideously uncivilized folk who have no right being where they are become the ruling power, the chronicles become somewhat more, somewhat kinder to them. I'm a sucker for grave goods, Dan. And so if you take someone like Childeric the First, probably the first Merovingian king we know very much about at all.
You start finding all those bees in the grave goods, don't you?
You find the gold bees. And, you know, so we're talking about a guy who died at the end of the 5th century, probably in 481. And, in this ornamental gold bees, signet rings, spears, axes.
Lots of garnet, you know, garnet everywhere. I love it.
Yeah. Oh, garnet everywhere. You know you've made it when you got a bit of garnet on you. So look, obviously, here is a society that has a luxurious material culture accessible at least to the people at the very, very top of it. Here probably is also a society that, like most societies in human history, doesn't really offer very much for the ordinary Joe at the bottom of it, just sort of subsisting as best he, she, and family can do. So I think, it's totally a question of who you're looking at and from what perspective. Certainly, I think as here's the thing about the Middle Ages in general, to sort of blow back into a big point. As the Middle Ages wear on, the evidence becomes fuller and the people start to seem a little bit more like us, you know, recognizable to a modern eye and somewhat more sympathetic. So, for example, it's much easier for us to sympathize and empathize and feel some kind of fraternity with Leonardo da Vinci at the end of the Middle Ages, you know, the universal genius, the man designing machines and dissecting bodies and painting great paintings, than it is for us even to put ourselves into the mind of Childeric the First with his lovely bees and garnets. Do you know what I mean? It just is easier because the time brings us closer to those people. So inevitably, I think when we look back very, very deep into the early Middle Ages, we can be somewhat appalled by the barbarity of the time.
You know, you make me think of something that I've always been fascinated with, and I don't know, I'd be very interested, maybe this is a future book I need to work on or something, but I'm fascinated. So like when we look back at Leonardo da Vinci, like you just said, we understand that there has been tremendous amount of change, and we're comfortable with the idea that Leonardo would have dressed differently, looked differently, lived in a different sort of milieu than what we do, and that's understandable. But when you look at, for example, a portrayal, so you had mentioned the later Middle Ages or the solid Middle Ages, let's just say the 14th century, right, 1300s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somebody, you'll see manuscripts with them portraying a much earlier historical event, so maybe something from Rome or maybe something from the Carolingians or what have you. But they portray it in contemporary terms, right? So the people will be wearing the same sort of armor that they would be wearing in the 14th century rather than armor that would have been, you know, something more of a... In other words, we acknowledge that the things in Leonardo's time are not going to be like our own. They don't necessarily do that in the artwork. Did people... And this may not be a question that Dan Jones is the right person to ask. But do people back then, when they're talking about the kings of yore or whatever, do they understand that they're going to be living in a different sort of technological sort of situation? Or is the assumption back then that everything is as everything was?
Well, this is a really good example because we do the same thing today. So let's take the let's drill down into the example you gave. Let's imagine a sort of 14th century French chronicle depicting the Song of Roland, probably the most famous story of the told in the later Middle Ages,
right in Spain Roland or southern France, right.
He's on his way back from northern Spain, fighting the Saracens in northern Spain, and he's ambushed in Roncesvalles and blows the horn to warn Charlemagne, you know, the great king of the Franks. That there's trouble afoot. And in blowing the horn, his temples burst and he dies a hero's death. Okay, the big story told in the 14th century, telling a heavily romanticized version of a story set in the late 8th century. So what is that? Well, 14 minus 8, my maths isn't very good. 600 years previous. I just watched... Okay, and in that 14th century telling, you're right, the drawings will have them in 14th century armor, and the mores of all the characters will essentially be 14th century. These will be 14th century people gadding about 600 years earlier. Now, I just watched Ridley Scott's The Last Duel, about a 14th century duel between two dudes over whether Adam Driver character, Jacques Legree, had raped the wife of Matt Damon, Jean de Carrouge. And of course, you know, what in the hands of the writers, Damon and Affleck, and the director, Ridley Scott, this has become a movie that is really about Hollywood politics and American gender politics in the 21st century. It's just put into... it just happens to be taking place in the 14th century. Now, the costume in that movie is the 14th century. So they're not all wandering about in skinny jeans with iPhones. I'll grant you that. We don't do that anymore. But what is obvious throughout that entire movie is that this is one big analogy for the modern world. So we're doing exactly the same thing in the 21st century as was being done in the 14th century. And we're aware that we're doing it. Now, the big question is, to what extent in the 14th century are they aware that this is a sort of fabricated vision of life, or that maybe it wasn't quite like this under Charlemagne. This is only really speculation, but I think that we must credit our historical forebears with some intelligence and self-awareness. I think we often write self-awareness out, you know, we don't credit self-awareness in historical figures enough. I think people realize that this is not maybe quite how it was, but this is also the best way to make this story recognizable to a modern audience. And so the attitudes between then and now, I don't think are really that radically different. Just the technologies are.
I think that's a great answer. And I think I should have made a distinction between the highly educated members of society and those who'd never had any education at all. And that you were just pointing out may not even know about these events. So you have to make them relatable. So let's talk about, because, you know, when I was a kid and I was so interested in European history, you tend to forget all of the outward pressures of the other civilizations that are impacting that history. And you mentioned the Saracens and the Song of Roland situation. So let's talk about that for a minute. One of the more interesting and little known, I would think, and something that we should study more here in the West is the great original Muslim conquests of the Arab and Byzantine and the other worlds. Can we talk a little bit about this? And can you, because I was trying to figure out if there was anything I could think of, historically speaking, from any era that was an analogy that made sense to that. That to me seems a singular, when you start, you know, looking at all the different angles, a sort of a singular event. Talk to me a little bit about the original Arab Muslim conquest, you know, when Islam first appeared on the stage and rolled over several traditional superpowers.
It's one of the most extraordinary episodes in the whole of the Middle Ages. I mean, arguably in
I would
the
say
whole
anything,
of the last
anytime,
two thousand,
yes,
any
anytime.
I think maybe so. The speed of conquest, and this is something you've obviously worked a lot on, is comparable with Genghis Khan's conquests. You know, that scale, that speed, that rapidity of a sort of a new movement. But what's different between the early Islamic conquests, you know, out of Arabia, through half of Byzantium, through the whole of North Africa, into Sicily, into Spain, all the way up to the Pyrenees, you know, in no time at all.
The edges of China. Think about that. I mean,
the edges of China. Right. And leaving an imprint in all of those places, from Transoxania to the Iberian Peninsula, you know, half the known world, that is in almost everywhere that the first Arab caliphs after Muhammad, the Rashid, you know, the rightly guided Rashidun caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Ali, through to the, all the way to, say, 750, the splitting point between the Umayyad Caliphate and the Abbasid. Almost everywhere that was conquered by the Arabs, by the Muslim Arabs, in those first generations of Islamic expansion, remains Islamic today. That imprint has lasted as long as all of the imprints the Middle Ages have left in terms of, you know, in the Western Christian world, the rule of law, the cathedrals, the castles that are all over, you know, Western Europe and England and Wales in particular, the music, the art, the elements of the political thought, just as much in the Arabic and Persian worlds, the first Islamic conquerors have left their mark. However, there is a schism that exists in scholarship between Christian, Western, Anglophone, as well as, you know, French and German scholarship and Islamic scholarship. And there are very few writers. You mentioned earlier on a book about the Crusades from the Islamic perspective. And I'm gonna place a small bet that you're thinking about Paul Cobb, his book, The Crusades Through Arab Eyes.
Yes,
I think it's that book. Fantastic book, but a very, very rare book. Almost nobody on either side is doing that. And because, so we still have this enormous historical schism. When I wrote the chapter in Powers and Thrones entitled Arabs, which narrates the story from, you know, Muhammad's life all the way up to 750 and the sort of the end of the expansions. I went into a totally new scholarship and I had to talk to completely new scholars. I called up my friend Samir Rahim, who's a brilliant, I've known for more than half my life, brilliant journalist. He's also a fantastic scholar of early Islam. And I said, Samir, you know what? I'm going to need a reading list here. And he sent me a long reading list, which I dug straight into. But there was no crossover with anything else that I was reading. Yeah, this was a scholarship that sat on its own, away from, you know, the rest of what I was reading for this history of the Middle Ages. And so we don't tend to think about the early Islamic caliphates as being part of quote unquote medieval history. And yet they were. You know, Chris Wickham, brilliant scholar of the early Middle Ages, wrote an amazing book called The Inheritance of Rome. And it asked the question, after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, what comes into that space? And he looks, and Wickham looks at the barbarian kingdoms. He looks at Byzantium in the east around Constantinople. He looks at the Franks, and he looks at, so he's one of the few scholars who looks at the Islamic caliphates. Now, when I think about that, the big question, who has the best claim out of those groups to really call themselves the heirs of Rome, I would argue it's probably the early Islamic caliphs, because they put together the biggest empire on Rome's patch, bonded by a single language, Arabic, whereas Rome had Latin, bonded by something approaching a common bureaucratic imperial culture that's all the way from, you know, Transoxania to Spain. There is this sort of common feeling, bonded by a coinage, bonded by a faith above everything, capable, you know, militarily fearsome, you know, all of these. Arguably, it's the Arabs who are the real heirs of Rome. But I can almost feel people bristling as they hear that, because we just don't connect these two things as being part of the same historical story.
Well, and maybe forget that. I mean, again, if we're looking at this from a geopolitical standpoint, and you put a map down from this era, you're going to see, I mean, this is how American military planners would look at it, right? They would say, well, look, you're surrounded over here in Spain, which is Moorish. North Africa's all Islamic. The Middle East is Islamic. The Byzantines are under siege. And in the north, you have non-Christian people. And this would have been where Christianity was considered almost a power block, the way we saw, communism and the free world as power blocks. So it's not your power block in the north. It's not your power block in Spain. It's not your power block in North Africa. And then if you're looking at this from a European point of view, you also have, and I love these cultures, you also have what you could call sort of what would you refer to? You'd call it the Berlin Wall of Europe, but it's what happens once you get to the plains of Hungary and the more flat territory that becomes the Great Steppe. And you've always had, I mean, Herodotus is talking about Cimmerians and Scythians, and the Romans would use those same terms for much later peoples. Mm. But you have, you know, we mentioned the Huns earlier. You've got an area there that just not only keeps the Europeans from expanding in that direction, but is continually pressuring towards the European direction, and it's one peoples after another, you know, from Magyars and Huns and Avars and Seljuks, and talk to me a little bit about this great wall on the eastern side of European culture that is the steppe people, who also, of course, you know, the other side of them is touching Chinese civilization, and they're acting as a conduit between the two worlds that are not only not connected, but in a lot of cases don't even know of each other's existence.
Right, and maybe the analogy is the way we sometimes talk about bodies of water being either...
That's a good one, very good, yes.
Roads or walls, right? You know, on a tiny scale, it's the English Channel is either a barrier or it's a bridge. The same is probably true of the Great Steppe that conjoins Eastern Europe with Northern China. Now, I think you're absolutely right. For the most part, that sort of keeps these big power blocks, these different peoples apart. However, when you come to suddenly the Mongols appear end of the 12th century, it becomes like a super highway. And for the right military superpower, as the Mongols turn out to be, that's a road. That's a super highway for them to charge along. I think if we're thinking about those big blocks that emerge in the Middle Ages, and to connect this a little bit with the role of Islam and the Arab speaking and Persian world, it's interesting. After the 8th century, roughly, those blocks don't really move very much, and it's only in, well, there's an expansion of the Western Christian world, isn't there? In Spain and Portugal, something interesting happens. The Reconquista is very, very unusual. Unlike the Crusades to Egypt, unlike the Crusades to the Middle East, you know, to the Near East, Eastern Mediterranean, there's a permanent change in the sort of faith groups which govern that territory. We can look at Northern Europe, the Baltic, Scandinavia. That too, there's a Christianizing process there. There's a Christianizing process in Poland and Hungary and so on. But it does that remains the block. Where Europe doesn't. It's not like the Crusaders go along that step, you know, marauding their way all the way to modern Beijing. Is it? You know, it's for the most part. I think you're right. I think that great steppe land is a barrier, and it's not. It doesn't become a conduit west to east. It's only ever really east to west.
One of the really interesting periods of history, I think, is the one where, you know, it's analogous, I think, to the American so-called conquest of the Old West, when the Russians begin to push, you know, 16th century, 17th century, they begin to push east, going after the various steppe tribes in that direction, and the Chinese simultaneously are pushing west. And it's only with the change in technology or whatever that they're able to master this weapon system that had dominated that area and kept those powers out for millennia. Let me shift a little bit, because I got another interesting people and I really want your take on it, because I've never known how to classify them or put them into the proper sort of place. How do we classify Normans? I mean, to me, this is one of the great, great. I mean, for those who don't know, we have this group of people, and I'll let Dan explain the background or the fusion that's always been, you know, blamed for creating these people. But they arrive on the world stage. I mean, this is a giant play, right? Human history is a giant play. You have certain characters, you know, we have American soap operas here in the United States that have been on TV for like 50 years. So we have this giant play, and there are certain characters that are always there. There's always the Chinese. There's always, you know, the Persians. But then there are these characters that come in and are really important to the story for a short period of time and then just sort of disappear. Talk to me a little bit about the Normans in that kind of a context.
Well, first we've got to think about what the word actually means.
Yes,
don't
yes, don't
and,
we? Yes.
It's connected with Northman. And the reason it's connected with that is because the Normans, you use the word fusion. I think that's exactly the right word. The Normans are a people who are created in a sort of a process like nuclear fusion between the Franks and the Vikings. So the Franks under Charlemagne, around the turn of the 8th into 9th centuries, had begun expanding from a state that bridged modern France and Germany. You know, it's the original European Union. It's France, Germany, Luxembourg, Austria, Northern Italy. It's like the 1950s version of the United, an economically united Europe. That's the core of the Carolingian Frankish world. And then there's sort of dual processes of expansion of the Frankish world. South over the Pyrenees into Muslim Iberia, and then north into the pagan lands of Saxony and up towards what becomes a Danish march, a sort of a liminal zone between the Christian Frankish people of the Frankish world, the Carolingian Frankish world, and the Vikings, the Scandinavian pagan people of the north. Now, over time, those people start to come into more and more regular contact with one another. And I'm quite persuaded by the line of thought that says the reason you start to see Viking raids in, you know, the reason the Vikings set up at Lindisfarne and the mouths of rivers all, you know, down modern France and at the end of the 8th century is because the Franks are starting to make themselves known, you know, make themselves known as a wealthy people who like to build monasteries, i.e. undefended wealthy places that are easy to raid. So anyway, the bigger point is little by little, the Franks and the Vikings come into more and more regular contact with one another, so that by the end of the 9th century, there's constant Viking raiding into the Frankish world. And a succession of Frankish kings have to sort of scratch their heads and wonder what on earth they're going to do about this. This is sort of settled eventually with the creation of Normandy, with the award of land around the River Seine and the city of, you know, the important city of what's now Rouen. This is settled upon, effectively, a bunch of Vikings, and the appeasement of the Vikings is by giving them a little portion of the Frankish state in which to live. Now, their accommodation with the Frankish world is most notably conversion to Christianity. And then over a few generations, you know, by the time we get to the middle of the 11th century, you have a sort of quite unique people, the people that produce famously William the Conqueror, the bastard of Normandy who invades England, or Robert Guiscard and Count Roger of Sicily down in southern Italy and Sicily, and scourges of Byzantium and popes all at the same time. But really, what are these Normans? They are a hybrid of Franks, Christian but quite warlike Franks, and Vikings, you know, out and out traveler, robber, pillager,
trader.
And and trader, of course. You mustn't forget trader. after they pillage you, they'll trade with you.
That's right.
So wonderful news. But they're an extraordinary people. I here in England, where I'm sitting right now, 1066 is, you know, one of those turning point dates in history. It's one of the biggest dates in the whole of English history. Better known even than our loss of the American colonies. You know, we're still much more hung up on the invasion by William, Duke of Normandy, than we are by the loss of the colonies. So the Normans get about, but it's not just England, because as I've just mentioned, it's also southern Italy. And I think the arrival of the Normans into southern Italy and the Norman conquest of Arab Sicily is a judderingly important historical moment, because it becomes that those Norman territories in southern Italy and Sicily become pivotal to the Crusades. And I think the Crusades, 30 years on from the Norman conquest, the First Crusade, that really is a historical turning point. That's something that everybody in the whole of the Western European world hears about. 1066 in England is not in that order of magnitude at all. The fall of Jerusalem in 1099 to Ifrange, yes, the Franks, but driven by the Normans, you know, Bohemond and crew at the heart of them. I think the expansion, the creation of Normandy and the expansion of the Normans into other parts of Europe, that's a really central part of the story of the High Middle Ages.
There are some interesting historical ironies. It's funny, you want to mention these historical ironies, but then you catch yourself and say, okay, is this a real historical irony, or is this something that just appears that way, you know, looking back from our modern eyes? But for example, here you have these Frankish people that are continually tying themselves to ancient Roman sort of behavior. The Franks right. themselves come into possession of the territories they're in because of Roman policies that brought barbarian people in and made deals with them, right? You defend this territory for the emperor and you can have it. Well, now you have the Franks, who are hundreds of years later essentially adopting the same policy with these Viking peoples. You can have a little of our Frankish territory, which was originally given to us by the Romans so we could defend it. So you can defend it. And they just did what the Franks did too and ended up creating their own empire based in Normandy. But it's interesting because it's not like the other empire. So if you think about like a Frankish empire in what's now modern day France morphing into France, if you think about what becomes the Holy Roman Empire morphing into Germany, but the Normans are more like a free agent people, if you will. Like the first question someone should have when you say the Normans in Sicily is you go, wait a minute. How did the Normans find themselves in Sicily? And are these Norman soldiers or are these... So in other words, trying to figure out and relate them to peoples. I mean, I was trying to figure out what the proper word for Normans is. Do you call Normans a tribe? Do you call them a family? Are they like proto-Habsburgs? They go around everywhere and rule multiple... You had mentioned at one point that you have Normans who are up at the wall between the Scottish and English borders up at Hadrian's Wall at the same time that they're all the way down at Sicily. They're moving towards the Middle East. I mean, who are these guys? And who makes up the soldiery? I mean, is there a Norman ethnic group? How does one put them in the normal boxes we're used to working with?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think part of this, I'd be interested to know what you think about this. Isn't part of it just the fact that by accident of history, there aren't really Norman, there's not a sort of autonomous Normandy anymore? Because we could say the same for the Burgundians, you know, that or maybe even the Gascons, you know, these people from different regions that have since been swallowed up.
Yeah, do you say they're absorbed, maybe? I mean, is that the way, or is absorbed or die out better? I mean, how does one associate this?
They are, I mean, the history of Normandy's rolled into France, isn't it, after 1204?
Right.
Because the Normans become kings of England, and then it splits up again. But by and large, in the early Plantagenet era, the Normans have become kings, and so the Duchy of Normandy is no longer the grandest of their possessions. They've also fused with the Counts of, in the Plantagenets, you have Dukes of Normandy, Counts of Anjou, and then they peg on Aquitaine as well.
And they're ruling England, but French is the language they speak to each other, correct?
French, yes. They're ruling England. Yeah, so... But by this time, we're not really talking about them in terms of a people or a tribe. We're not in that barbarian era anymore, because really we've switched our thinking as historians by this point to thinking about ruling dynasties. And so when we talk about the Normans in the late 12th century, early 13th century, what we really mean is a very small aristocratic, you know, a tiny royal family and a very small aristocratic group connected to that family. And really, you could be anybody as long as you're connected to the Duke of Normandy, then you're quote unquote a Norman. And similarly, in the south, you know, Count Roger of Sicily, well, before he's Count Roger of Sicily, he's a Norman dude in southern Italy. But once he becomes Count Roger of Sicily, and then subsequently, you know, King Roger II of Sicily, the fact of Normanness is now hidden underneath the grander title of King of Sicily, or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And because we're not talking about tribal groups anymore, because we can draw in much clearer detail as historians, the pictures, the portraits, you know, the pen portraits, I mean, of ruling individuals. We stop really being concerned with peoples in general and start concentrating on people in specific. Now, that ought to lead us to think, well, hang on a second, then when we're in the barbarian period and we're talking about the Franks, the Burgundians, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, are we really talking about a people who are going around singing, hey ho, we're the Franks, hey ho, we're the Visigoths, watch out for us, mate? And or are these just historical terms we have to use because of the paucity of evidence? We're just aware that a group of people, a ruling group of people, moved into a certain area. This is a problem of wildly different evidence, I think, between the early Middle Ages the high slash later Middle Ages.
It's funny because when we think, we had just mentioned the Arab conquest earlier, and when you think about that in military terms, there's like a domino effect where they'll conquer people and they become larger and larger and more powerful and more capable. But the Normans are kind of an opposite sort of thing. And I'm trying to figure out what accounts for their success. Like over the eras, the viewpoint had changed. I remember when we used to war game the Normans, they always tried to figure out some sort of war gaming advantage you can give them to try to provide on the battlefield some semblance that displayed the fact that these guys are doing amazing things. I mean, if you read the Byzantine chroniclers, for example, who thought all Franks were irresistible chargers and whatnot, but even they seem impressed by Normans and Norman leaders and whatnot. Talk to me a little bit about what might explain a relatively small number of people. The Normans are not some giant state. They're not creating the same sort of domino effect and absorbing other peoples as steppe peoples did, as the Arabs did. What the heck did these guys bring to the table, whether it's on a personal level, a personality level, or a military level, that might account for this success?
Well, I think on a personality level, it's always tempting to see the kind of Viking, outwardly mobile mentality, right?
Describe what these guys looked like for a second. Describe what the Byzantines were seeing when they ran into Normans as people. Well,
So the best images that we have, particularly that you could tell a Norman by the sort of long teardrop shaped shield.
But they look like Dolph Lundgren, don't they? The descriptions of
right. Well, and Beaumont. Anna Comnini writes about Beaumont. Oh, Beaumont of Toronto. One of the most prominent Normans among the first Crusaders. Oh, I mean, she's so conflicted in her account of Beaumont, because on the one hand he's a bastard, but on the other hand he's super handsome and he's a broad chest and he's really really quite dishy.
short blonde hair and clean shaven. I mean, what the heck is that? Right.
Come on, he's sort of
he's a model
star, right? But I think in your war game, or certainly in England, look at the Norman conquest in England. In your war game, is castles. Normans are great castle builders.
Yes.
That's their military. That's their super source, isn't it? They come very well organized and very capable of building these fortifications, which house bodies of knights who are similar to Frankish knights. You know, the Frankish knight, as the Byzantine chronicles you're talking about,
make a hole through the walls of Babylon, right? Isn't that the line?
Through the walls of Babylon. Yeah, that Frankish charge, you know, couched lance charge, that's dangerous. That's a battlefield leveler against the traditional sort of light cavalry mounted archer who's going to feign retreat and then pepper you and you come to chase it. But I think the Normans in England, it's castle building. That's their superpower, don't you think?
Well, I do. Except you have a hard time sometimes trying to put into perspective. I mean, if this is the kind of conversations you'd have on a wargaming table. I apologize to people, but I mean, you would sit here and say something like, "Okay, is a Norman just another knight? And are knights the people that we consider to have this?" See, everything is rock, paper, scissors. I'm talking to the audience now, but everything is rock, paper, scissors when it comes to this kind of warfare, because we can extol the value of a Western knight, for example, in hand-to-hand combat or charging through the walls of Babylon, as the Byzantine chronicler said, and yet that's useless against a Magyar or an Avar or a Hun if you can't catch them, or a Saracen in the Holy Land. So everything is sort of the rock, paper, scissors kind of thing. What I can't figure out is, if a Norman knight is no better than a Frankish knight, then how does one differentiate? I mean, there's so many more Frankish knights, right? And they build castles too, and they all use the same weaponry. So you try to figure out, see, in the old days, when people would talk about different ethnic groups having different tendencies, they would talk about, 100 years ago, they would say the Normans were possessed with the spirit of their Viking ancestors and the same sort of, and they're trying to explain what accounts for this dominance. 15 years ago, they would have talked about economic differences and savvy, you know, capitalist traders. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out how you explain the rise of a people that don't have the traditional sorts of things that one would look at, an economic base, a population base, a religious explanation. They seem like they shouldn't be where they are, if that makes sense.
And yet they're, but then maybe, you know, this has been super unfashionable for a long time, but I just have a sense it might be coming back. This great man theory of history, which we great person theory of history, let's call it now. We had an almost beaten out of us, haven't we, Dan?
Yes, beaten out of us is a good way to put it.
Come on, it's not that. However, I have this little suspicion that into the next, that historical trends to come around, as we've already discussed, and in a society as we live in now, which is super, super, super individualistic and completely focused on the, you know, the individual as being the most important thing, and society as being really not very important at all, unless it bends specifically to the will of the individual. And of course, we're living politically in an age of strongmen and would-be tyrants. This, the influence of the sort of remarkable individual might just be coming back into fashion in history. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, because what are we really talking about in terms of the Normans? Who are the ones who is it that makes these great plays that puts them out there? Well, in England, William the Conqueror. I mean, all bets are off. For a Norman conquest of England without William the Conqueror, I find very hard to imagine. Not, you know, not just the sort of military organization, but then the vision to completely redesign England, to move the bishoprics about, to bring across this new sort of colonizing group. Now, that is the brainchild of one extraordinary leader. And similarly, down in Sicily, we are talking about a pair of brothers, Robert Guiscard and Roger.
It's funny, too, because energy was the word I recall hearing when I was young. Energy. The Normans had such energy.
They had energy. But maybe just like a few of them had some energy. Guess what they went and did, right? And after that, who knows? As you're saying, is it really the Normans at all? I mean, certainly the Arabs. Well, as you're saying, the Arabs couldn't tell any difference, could they? Not really. They say, well, they're all the Franks. They all look the same to me.
They all look the same to me. So let's talk for a minute, because we had mentioned earlier, looking back and taking, you know, what was the line from the Ohio State historian, right? That history is the present politics projected onto the past. And we talked about climate change. There's another one, though, that I found, you know, and it's funny because we've talked extensively about this, too. So it's funny how on one level you can know about it and on another level not think about it. But, I mean, you had gone into the Justinian plague so well. Let's talk. Everybody knows about the Black Death. But the Justinian plague is really, isn't that the Black Death part one? Or if this is a movie trilogy, the Black Death is the original Godfather or Exorcist or Jaws. Let's talk a little bit about that and maybe give us an idea, because these people in the time of the Justinian plague are accustomed to disease being a terrible and regular occurrence. But how does something like that stand out in an era where they're accustomed to pandemics or terrible disease outbreaks?
The Justinianic plague in the 6th century, named for the great Byzantine emperor Justinian, is a form of Yersinia pestis. It's plague. It's the same as the Black Death. And insofar as we can tell, because the evidence is much scantier for the Justinianic plague and is also back projected from the Black Death, which is a problem we might get into in a minute, it seems to do a similar thing to what happens in the 14th century, the Black Death, which is it mutates and becomes very infectious. Just as COVID-19 is a coronavirus, one of a group of viruses that became incredibly virulent and incredibly infectious. So you sometimes see with plague, it just mutates and becomes super, super, super infectious. And that's what you have in the 6th century with the Justinianic plague. And it seems to spread from it finds its way into Egypt. Maybe from Zanzibar, maybe from East Africa. It's very, very hard to know for sure. And then it rips into the Byzantine, the Eastern Roman Empire. And you have these accounts from Byzantine chroniclers of lockdowns, of thousands of people dying each day, of bodies piling up in the streets, of everybody being complete and terrified of catching this disease, and there being, you know, scarcely enough living to bury the dead. There is there's evidence that the disease found its way as far afield, certainly as Germany, into Western Europe. There is massive disparity in the estimates of how many people died of the Justinianic plague, which ranges from tens of millions to about 100,000. We just don't know. The accounts give us the impression that this was, just as the Black Death in the 14th century was, which we do know killed up to 60% of populations wherever it struck, this was pretty apocalyptic. Traditionally, we've been, you know, I think that the historians have been on a journey towards saying, well, maybe the Justinianic plague wasn't as bad as we thought, and these accounts of pandemic disease do seem very overblown. But I tell you what, you read them during a global pandemic, and suddenly, you know, you're back to thinking, well, maybe actually these guys had a point, you know. I found that certain writing about Justinianic plague and the Black Death during a pandemic, it's impossible not to have your perspective as a historian changed.
Let me give the listeners an example of your writing here on the Justinian plague. This is a quote from Dan Jones's book. Quote, John of Ephesus was sent off by the emperor to baptize pagans in Asia Minor, but he found himself traveling through a death zone. In town after town, the sick and suffering staggered through the streets, their bellies swollen and mouths hanging open, eyes bloodshot, pus leaking from their mouths. Grand houses in which entire families and their servants had died stood silent, every room occupied by corpses. Contorted bodies lay unburied, their midriffs rotting and bursting in the heat of the day. The flesh half eaten by hungry dogs. The roads and highways were empty. The usual thrum of trade and traffic interrupted. In desolate villages, no one was left to harvest crops and fruit trees. Animals were left unshepherded to roam the countryside as they pleased. End quote. That's heavy duty stuff. And all of a sudden makes you feel like the pandemic you're living in now. You become very grateful for modern medical technology, don't you?
Yeah, you sure do. But let me tell you, I mean, all of that passage that you quoted there, I've drawn on. The reason John of Ephesus is presented as the lead character is that's his account. I mean, that's just my putting it into sequence. And so this isn't some sort of purple prose flight of fantasy. This is what your man saw and wrote down. And as I was saying, you know, I was writing that right at the I think I wrote that in March, maybe April 2020. So that's peak COVID terror lockdown. And it's impossible to write that without, you know, during a pandemic, without feeling a degree more sympathy for John of Ephesus than one might have done had I written it a year earlier. When you begin pandemic, oh, well, you know, really, can it have been quite so bad? But this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, which is what I don't do in that chapter that you just quoted is then really push the point much harder and say, see, this is just like COVID-19. You just let that rise out of the text. And I think I hope anyone reading that in the next, say, 5-10 years will go, my God, yeah, that sounds really familiar. Man, maybe I've got a little more in common with these medieval people than I thought, I might have thought I did.
I wrote a chapter in my book, which came out 4 months before the pandemic, called Pandemic Prologue, ? And then in 4 months, it was completely outdated and obsolete. So I know exactly what you're talking about. I would have loved the perspective of maybe being able to look at our own time and draw some comparisons. I probably would have done it in too heavy-handed a way. So the way you did it is wonderful.
but I think you'd have done it brilliantly. And because you're a fantastically skilled historian. I think it is just, look, when I made that list I told you about, climate change, mass migration, pandemic disease, technological change, global networks, pandemic disease was third. on the list for a reason. Like, this was before COVID, and I was like, and it was actually the thing I thought might be hardest to sell. Look, I knew I was going to have to write about Justinianic Plague. I knew I was going to have to write about the Black Death, but I was like, how am I going to sell this to a 21st century audience as being something that connects the modern to the medieval when the closest thing we've had is SARS, and that's 2004, and that's the Far East. Like, is an American audience really going to buy the danger of a pandemic in the 21st century? Now, I was aware that actually clever people in, certainly in the UK government, and I think in the US government as well, who were pulling risk assessments for the biggest dangers of the present day, were putting pandemic disease right at the top. But dang, I mean, I didn't see one coming. Did you? No.
Well, I mean, I was, you know, you would hear people like Bill Gates talking for a very long time, talking about it's a law of averages thing, right? Eventually you're going to, it's going to turn, the die roll is going to turn up wrong, and we're going to get unlucky. And then you hope that your ability to pivot, medically speaking, can help you avoid this sort of tragedy John of Ephesus was writing about. So maybe now, because we've dealt with a bunch of different things and I'm jumping around, but looking at my notes, there's one little jump I'd like to make, and it's a perspective question, right? And maybe this is another one of those things that, let's hope not, but that has some echoes in our own times. I was curious about the way, and this is really how, you know, your book starts with the Roman Empire and then moves on from there. I'm fascinated by the way that the transition from a Roman Republic, which, you know, if we're looking at it from our perspective now, whether it's the UK or the United States, you would say, oh, a representative, you know, these terms don't really apply to Rome, but we'll use them anyway. A representative government is the superior form of government to something like an autocracy or a totalitarian state or an empire or an imperial system that has an emperor who has control of people. But that's not how someone like Augustus Caesar's changing, you know, and of course he had several successors afterwards who helped codify these changes. But I mean, they didn't look at that as a totalitarian ruler coming to power on the ashes of a superior system, right? A system of representation and wide distribution of power. How come we don't look at someone like Augustus Caesar as taking, I mean, if it happened in Germany in 1932, we would say that a republic was destroyed and on its back was a dictatorship, but it would be seen completely different. How come we view the Roman transition from a republican form of government to something else in a more positive light? Is it because compared to what the republic was at the very end, it was a more positive light? Or is this more of us viewing it from... you know, I mean, I suppose the British Empire in the late 19th century might have viewed it differently, but it seems to me that you're celebrating something that if it happened today, we would consider to be a terrible thing.
Yeah, but I think it's a special case, isn't it? And
That's a good way to put it. So the
turn against empire as a historical trend right now is profound, right? And I mean, you've got in London here, people... Actually, you know, people sort of defacing Churchill's statue. You know, I talked to one of my kids about Churchill. I was doing something to do with Churchill the other day, TV wise, and I mentioned Winston Churchill to one of them. They're ages 12 and 9, the elders ones, and the 12-year-old said, "Churchill, yeah, I heard of that guy. He's the racist guy, right?" I'm like, "Wait, hold on a second." There are other things I might need to tell you about Winston Churchill as well as that very salient fact. You know, the turn against the British Empire it's turned. The turn against imperialism per se, and yet we still remain sort of strangely sort of in love with Rome, just as our medieval forebears were, despite the fact this is one of the very few pure, true slave states in the history of the world.
Yes.
And we're like, yeah, but I mean, the statues and the underfloor heating, man. The underfloor heating. Like, yeah, I challenge anybody to go to the ruins of a Roman villa, probably built by slaves on wealth pillaged from people the Romans considered inferior to themselves on what we'd now call eugenic basis. And everyone wander around going, shit, man, the floor must have been super nice and warm. These people, they had it, you know. They had it right. You know, for some reason, we hive Rome off into a special case. The turn from republic into empire wasn't a good thing. I mean, the best representation of this I've ever seen is in it's one of Robert Harris's novels, in which he you know, through Cicero's eyes, spells out pretty clearly what a corrupt stitch up this destruction of the republic and creation of the empire really was. But we're still not quite inclined to see it that way, because just as our medieval forebears were, we're still blindly in love with Rome.
You know, you bring up, it's unfortunate perhaps that this late in the conversation you bring up something like this question of context in the way we view the past now, because it's such a big thing here in the States, for example. And I know, you know, but it's worth delving into it just a tad, I think, because I have you here and I'm going to exploit the moment. But but it seems to me that if you're going to be fair, it is wrong to hold people from, say, the Middle Ages, because that's what your book is about, to our modern standards of behavior, ethics, morals, and those sorts of things. And I think most people would agree with that. And then it's perfectly fine to do that to people from 10 years ago. So there's going to be some time period between those two when all of a sudden the forgiveness that comes with living a very long time ago goes away, and you're penalized for not jumping on board the more, shall we say, modern ethical bandwagon when you did. So it seems to me that a guy, you know, we do it with the people, the so-called founding fathers here, who were all born mm-hmm. British citizens, let's remember, mm-hmm. People who looked back on the Glorious Revolution as one of their main influences, that you look at those. So Thomas Jefferson's my favorite, because to me, wrapped up in that figure is all of the contradictions and hypocrisies that are built into the American founding, right? Here's the guy who all by himself is almost all by himself, along with the earlier Enlightenment thinkers who influenced him, are responsible for the greatest marketing messages to ever come out of this country, right? Freedom, liberty, the rights of man, you know, all men are created, all the stuff that we emphasize in our own marketing campaigns as a country. And yet, obviously, the man owned slaves. He was having, I'm going to say, a relationship, which is the really wrong word for this, with his own slave. I mean, you look at him and it's clear from his own view. He's trying to eliminate slavery long term on one hand, but he's doing nothing to eliminate it in his own life. So you look at someone like that, you say, OK, here's a guy who's going to be trapped because he doesn't come from 300 years earlier, which probably would have exempted him from modern moral questions. And he doesn't come from 200 years later, which would have made it absolutely, you know, there's no excuse for it. He's in that transition period where some people realize that this practice is wrong, so you need to jump on the bandwagon. One can say the same thing about Churchill. Here's a guy born into a world where so many of his peers and the way he was raised and everything thought the way he did, and then he lived to be 90-something, right? And all of a sudden, you know, things changed and he was left, you know, and I remember reading in the 1920s and 1930s, they were already thinking of him as an almost embarrassing political dinosaur in some British circles. How should we, and this may be something that's not fair to even ask you, but how should we roll with the punches here in trying to figure, I mean, with Jefferson, I always try to say, well, laud him for the good stuff and punish him for the bad stuff. How should someone look at someone like Churchill whose lifetime extends over a period where the morality, even in his own world and in the circles he ran with, evolved past his opinion?
Well, look, Churchill was old-fashioned even in his own time, and was a, you know, in many, made many, 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 many mistakes, was constantly behind the curve, was in some ways living a sort of a strange, slightly masochistic tribute act to his father.
Yes.
Who nevertheless, in the 1930s, or at the end of the 1930s, into 1940, at the point at which this person would, in almost every other circumstances, have just been written out of public life, was there at the right moment and was exactly the right person for that role of leadership. Now, that's the story of Churchill. And we, the correct historical thing to do is say, look, what were the moral standards, ethics, and mores of the day? Put aside whether you agree with them or not. What were they in that day? What was right in that day and what was considered wrong in that day? And how did that person fit into that moral world? Now, you do that with Churchill. You still don't come out with super great guy. You come out with person who people thought was, you know, there were many people had a problem with, even in his own day, who cometh the hour, cometh the man. Everyone said, do you know what? Actually, this is, maybe this is the right person. Now, that's the grown-up way of doing history. But, oh, dear, I'm going to sound like such an old man now. But we're in such a sort of childish cultural space at the moment and such an individualistic space at the moment that many historians and many non-historians sort of dipping their toes in the water think that history's all about them, and that the practice of history is about going around telling people off for not having lived up to an ideal moral standard, and that is really the most important thing that a historian or someone engaging in history can do. That and it's pathetic. But I think the point in general is that we are in this moment, and what I also didn't mean to suggest that this was a unique moment in human history. It's a cycle, you know.
Yes.
What was the book that would? There's a book about that transition from the Georgian to the Victorian called The Age of Kant, and I think that there's a similar sort of moralism. In its
K-A-N-T, correct? K-A-N-T?
No, not the philosopher. C-A-N-T.
C-A-N-T, okay, sort of, thank you. Yes.
From Kantar. So it's by Vic Gattrell. And it's about this sort of, well, the verb is this canting, pious rhetoric, which pervades public discourse, in which everyone is trying to say the most moral thing, and that to slip up will be to invite ridicule, scorn, and possibly, disadvancement in one's career. There's a similar sort of pious censoriousness about public discourse now. Now, I think it may be, and I write about this in Powers and Thrones at the end of the book, I think it may be that it is connected to new communications technology. So let's take a good medieval example of an age of Kant, C-A-N-T, from printing, the printing press in the 1450s, right, comes along and makes it vastly easier to communicate en masse, to communicate at speed. And what do you see happening in public discourse in the decades afterwards? It becomes incredibly moralistic, incredibly censorious, people attacking one another all over the place, and you have a culture war that emerges, which is what we call the Reformation. Now, there's an analogy to be drawn there with the age of the iPhone and social media, the immediacy and the availability of publishing and of publishing at scale. And what do you see happening immediately to human discourse? It becomes very, very fractious and very, very sort of pompous. And that's the moment we're living in at the moment. That's the moment we're living in right now. So it's definitely not anything new in terms of the long view of human history. It's just, for me, as you can tell, quite irritating to actually live through.
Well, let me validate what you said about cycles too. And I'm going to blame the British. I'm going to blame the British for this since I have one of them. But I mean, in the early history of the Americas, when you have Puritans and all this sort of thing, we were shunning, we were shaming, we were banishing from the public sphere. I mean, this is how things were done. I feel like we've just taken that quintessentially proto-American quality, added social media to it, made sure that there is no, see, at least the public shaming and all those things that were going on in those Puritan communities, there was one moral standard. Now we have multiple moral standards, and you can be shamed for any of them by the groups that associate with those morals. I mean, it's public shaming on steroids with social media. So, I mean, I feel like this is the same cycle with some amplification involved. So, so we'll blame that on the British and call it good, right?
Fine. Okay. That feels like we're even.
You brought up Georgian stuff. I'm just going a little earlier. here. Listen, is there anything I didn't bring up that you want to? I mean, first of all, the book is wonderful. It is one of those books, and I can hear my mother's voice in my head. Who, if you read this book from cover to cover and remembered it, you would have a giant chunk of your Western historical knowledge completely filled in. Is there anything, because it's 1,000 pages almost, I'm sure I left out all the best parts. What did I leave out that we should get into?
Oh, man. I mean, there's just so much. I had such a blast writing. I've written dynastic history, Plantagenets and Wars of the Roses before this. I'd written some religious military history with Templars and Crusaders. I've done some, you know, constitutional history of Magna Carta. I actually really enjoyed getting into the architectural, the literary, the...
Carolingian script was fascinating.
Even the sort of later stuff, you know, I read, there's a chapter in the book on called Builders, which is about, it's sort of set in the 13th century, and it's about castle building, which I've made some TV shows for Netflix about castles. And it's about Gothic architecture. And I just got to pull into that all my experience. I was writing in lockdown, so I couldn't travel a lot, but I got to pull in all my memories and experiences and notes about traveling to great Gothic cathedrals in England and elsewhere. And I loved bringing in that aspect of it. I loved doing the chapter called Renewers, which goes from Petrarch and Dante and Terza Rima and this sort of new poetry of the 13th century into the great painters, Van Eyck, you know, moving oil painting somewhere it had never been before, to Da Vinci, you know, the universal genius, and as we've said already, this figure who connects the medieval and the modern so brilliantly. I'm trying to say that actually my takeaway from the Middle Ages, or what I hope people will take away from my book about the Middle Ages, is that there's a lot of dudes slaying each other, and that's a constant in history. But there's also, I hope more than any book I've done, this sort of a much richer texture to life in the Middle Ages, and a greater sense of the legacy, the visual, artistic, cultural legacy that this extraordinary age brought to us. But I mean, we could be talking another 2 hours. And we'd still get nowhere near.
And Dan, let's not be surprised that you come on this show and somehow artwork gets the short shrift. It was just going to happen, okay?
You knew there was going to be charging
through the walls of Babylon and not enough Da Vinci. Yeah. That's how it goes.
That's how it goes. But look, I could talk to you all day because, you know, I'm a huge fan of yours. I think what you've done for history and the public, you know, the way you fed the public appetite for history in this medium and with your books is it's extraordinary, and you're doing a great thing. And I know that, you know, well, you know this, and I'm just flattering you. But I'm not.
That's when it's time for the show to end, Dan. That's when we know it's time for the show to end.
Right? All right.
Once we start complimenting the host, it's done, okay? My friend, thank you so much. The book is fantastic. Powers and Thrones. Everybody should get a copy. I read the PDF. I'm hoping to get a copy myself someday. I will buy it. Don't worry. We don't need any freebies around here. It was worth it. It's fantastic. And ladies and gentlemen, Dan Jones has been doing good work for a while. I have to be honest, and maybe it's just because the subject matter is so comprehensive. So far, it's my favorite book you've ever written. So,
thanks, brother. That's super kind.
My thanks to Dan Jones for coming on the program. That was a lot of fun. His new book, Powers and Thrones, A New History of the Middle Ages, is scheduled to come out November 9th, 2021. So may or may not yet be out by the time you get this show. His other books, of course, currently available and worth getting if you've not been exposed to that, The Plantagenets, Crusaders, the Templars, Magna Carta. You know, if the Middle Ages and this region of the world is something you really like or think you might, Dan Jones is one of the really good people to tell you all about it. I'm being strenuously reminded, because I am, and there ought to be a registered trademark symbol after this phrase, the worst marketer in the world, that I should probably tell everyone or remind everyone that as the holiday gift-giving season approaches, You know, if you can't think of anything else out there, or you run out of time or whatever it might be, really hard, weird person to buy for maybe, that we do sell the archived Hardcore History shows, either singly or in bunches, from the website. I think we worked it out so that it's priced at, like, if you buy the whole catalog, it's like $1 an hour, works out to content-wise. I hope that's fair. We also have some new merchandise on the way, different design stuff, but I don't know when it's coming in, frankly. Hope it makes it for the holidays. Not sure yet. We do have gift certificates available. And we have another method we just hooked up recently that we're trying out to give another option to people who buy. Again, you know, as the worst marketer in the world, I'm told to make sure I explain this, but it involves another way to get our premium feed so that it works better with, for example, people with certain kinds of podcatchers than our old system or our current system on the website. So more options, we figure, is better for everyone. So check that out if that sounds good to you. And for those who ask, because I know you always do, we are currently working on the next big Hardcore History show. I don't know when it's going to be ready. It's the same old problem that it always is. And I hope we can get these little, you know, appetizers out to keep you from starving to death, you know, between main courses. But thank you for everything, everybody. As always, I'm very grateful. Stay safe.
Support us with Patreon by going to patreon.com/DanCarlin. Or go to our donate page at dancarlin.com/dc-donate.
Thanks again for all your Buck a Show donations. They're the reason we're still here.
At the end of the last HHA show, we mentioned the folks over at Battle Guide Virtual Tours. And I'm going to continue to do that for a little while because I think if you're interested in military history, and not everyone is, so let's just say that right off the bat. But if you are, you know how difficult it is sometimes to get your mind around what's going on at some of these battles. If you pull out a map, or you're reading a book, or you're watching a documentary, or whatever it might be, there's so much going on at so many different levels that even if you are on the ground at like one of these tours that you can go on, there's still, it's hard to get a sense through the fog of war and the terrain, what's hidden from, I mean, battles are complicated things, right? So during the pandemic that happened, I was in touch with a group called Battle Guide Virtual Tours, who were people that did real tours. And like so many businesses around the world, we're trying to figure out how to pivot and keep some sort of a business going when no one knew when there were going to be any tourists or anyone who wanted to visit battlefields in person anymore, right? But the way that they figured out how to do this, and this is just my opinion. I mean, they may have a different opinion, but I think it's like the Hershey's peanut butter cup commercial. You got your chocolate in my peanut butter, and oh, it's better than ever. I love what they did to create something you could download at home. And as I told them, I mean, it's wonderful to be able to take one of those once-in-a-lifetime trips to a battlefield somewhere that you've always wanted to go to, but what if you want to go to another one the week afterwards or something like that? I mean, this opens the door to people getting to see lots of battlefields with this sort of approach. And the approach is, you'll have to see it for yourself, and that's what I'm really here to tell you, is that you can do that for free and just see if you like it, and then if you like it, you know, you can take it from there. I'm not going to convince you one way or the other. I just wanted you to get an idea of, from a perspective of somebody who's always trying to understand these things. Without all these elements, it's hard. And the way that they've put it together is something I think is pretty cool. And if you're into military history, and if you feel like I do, that you'd really like to better understand everything going on at some of these battles, go see if you like any of these battles that they offer. Go to battleguide.co.uk/Carlin, battleguide.co.uk/Carlin, and get one of the free shows that's put aside for you and just see what you think.